So I'm assuming for the moment that everybody can hear me. And I want to begin by kind of picking up where we left off last week. I see Binyamin and Judy are here from last week. Rachel, I don't think you were here in the previous weeks, but we'll try to kind of do a brief kind of summary of what we've been talking about. First of all, as opposed to the previous weeks when we had some trouble with the sources, this time I think I managed to come up with a neat solution. The sources that we're going to talk about today are actually simply available on the internet. So I posted the two links to those sources at the top of the chat box. And if you scroll up to the top of the chat box, you will find a source, a URL for Sefer HaKuzari translated into English and Maharal's Tiferet Yisrael chapter 7 in the original Hebrew. Okay. Now what I want to do is kind of bring us up to date as to where we were as of last week, and then kind of launch in back into Sefer HaKuzari and Maharal, which is where we had left off. We had begun 2 weeks ago by discussing Rambam's attempt to do a rational Ta'amei HaMitzvot, and his attempt to claim two critical things. Number one, that all mitzvot have a function. I'm avoiding the term reason because for Rambam and its support of the medievals who we're discussing today, the real issue is not... Okay, Binyamin does not see the source link. They should be at the top of the chat box. If they're not there, maybe because you logged in afterwards, let me post them again. Here is the Kuzari. Here is the Maharal. Okay, back to the issue of function. Right, for Rambam and for the medievals who we're discussing, the issue is not so much a question of reason as much as it's a question of function. How do the mitzvot function in a way that brings people to some larger goal or brings humanity to some larger goal? And for Rambam, every mitzvah has a function. You can identify its function, but Rambam has a bit of a problem in trying to claim, following his rationalism. Position that every mitzvah has a function, he has a problem explaining various mitzvot that on the surface do not appear to have a function, and this leads him in the direction, number one, of historicization, number one, claiming that some of the mitzvot are responses to the historical conditions at the time, and without ever claiming, in fact, denying explicitly that that this could ever lead to abandoning actual observance of the mitzvah, he claims that the function of some of the mitzvot, social, spiritual, and intellectual, is to wean people away from idolatry, and so it is historically conditioned. At a time when people were deeply involved in idolatry, it was necessary to gradually wean them off of it through various practices that were designed as responses to the idolatrous practices of the time. The other thing he does to try to kind of ease the problem of his claim that only sort of a function is that he claims that the details do not. Not only does he claim that the details do not by accident, he claims that the details couldn't. Any legal system at some point has to come up with some kind of line, distinction, numbers, particular details, and those details are going to be to a certain degree arbitrary, and he thinks that that's true both of halakha, of mitzvot, and of any other legal system. And this led to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's critique of Rambam's rationalism. We saw a critique in Sefer HaKuzari in which he says, basically, that when it comes to understanding of mitzvot, you can't ask questions, you can't challenge. More than that, he says, if we're looking at Sefer HaKuzari, section 1, chapter 99, which is not there in the link that I just gave you, but But he points out that had mitzvot been rational, had they been the kinds of things that you could figure out how to do them, then we would have seen prophets among the other nations. Now, Rav Yehuda Halevi is making a two-pronged argument, and it's a kind of two-pronged argument, the first prong of which is an assumption, and that is that there is no prophecy among the other nations, and he thinks that that's an empirical fact. But more importantly, what Maharal is getting at is the idea that mitzvot at some level have a certain goal. The function is trying to achieve that goal, and that goal involves creating the kinds of people who can be prophets, and therefore, kind of the measure you have in order to determine whether or not that function is being played out is a practical one. You can look around and you can say, well, are mitzvot, are these people becoming prophets? And if the answer is no, then you have no choice but to draw the conclusion that something in their particular practice is not leading toward that goal. And therefore, he says, if you could figure out what mitzvot ought to lead to prophecy, then everyone else would have done it. And he says, as a matter of empirical fact, so he claims, they haven't. And then we saw Maharal taking this a step further and saying there are those philosophers who come along and suggest that we ought to be able to give an accounting of the function of all mitzvot. And these philosophers, well, says Maharal, we don't even have to answer their question. We don't have to answer their question because they don't give us even a good accounting of nature. They don't give an accounting of the function of all the limbs and organs of animals. They can't explain to us everything about the function of plants. And therefore, we don't even have to answer their question about mitzvot. Now, this, on the surface, appeared to be kind of, didn't seem to be much of an argument. The fact that they haven't figured out everything about nature yet doesn't mean they don't have a good question about mitzvot. It's not clear what Maharal meant when he said, well, we don't even have to answer their question because science itself has not led us to all the answers. And the way we tried to explain that was to suggest that Maharal's primary point is that the world is not a rational place. The attempt to give a rational accounting of all mitzvot really sees an analysis of Torah and mitzvot as a subcategory of an analysis of the world. But if it's true that reason cannot give us a complete, total, and full analysis of the world, so why should I begin with the assumption that reason can give me a complete and full and total analysis of what mitzvot are for? And that we kind of, that was the point at which we had left things last week. And this kind of leads us to the question that is going to stand at the center of the discussion today, which is, once Rav Yehuda Halevi and Maharal have joined hands in the non-rational camp, or even the anti-rational camp, you cannot give a rational, functional explanation of every mitzvah. So what kind of language can they use to give an accounting at all? In other words, they're not prepared to simply say mitzvot are arbitrary, although we'll see that position to a certain degree in the modern period in the next couple of weeks. They're not prepared to say that mitzvot are arbitrary, nor are they prepared to say that mitzvot can be explained in rational terms. So what's the alternative? If they're not arbitrary and they're not rational, what are they? And here, what I want to do today is take a look at some of the sources in Sefer HaKuzari and Maharal and to try to get through them a sense of what kind of alternative language they come up with. I'm not sure how satisfied I am by what they suggest, but let's read it and see if we can make some sense out of it. Let's start with Kuzari, section 2, paragraph 45. If you click on the Kuzari link, or if you copy it into your web browser, you should get, it's a kind of wiki source page that has the entire text of Sefer HaKuzari in English. If you scroll down to paragraph 45, the paragraphs are numbered. If you scroll down to paragraph 45, the paragraph begins, "The interesting comparison has completely riveted my attention, but I should expect to see more hermits and ascetics among you than among other people." Has everybody got that? If you don't have it, let me know at some point. In addition, if you have questions, if you have issues you want to discuss, if you want to kind of intercede, mention something in the chat, and that will help us get to find out. Okay, so if we are on paragraph 45, he says, the king in the conversation between the king and the chaver, the rabbi in this translation, says, I regret, well, the king has said, given what you've just said about piety and the nature of piety, I should expect to see more hermits and ascetics among you than among other people. In other words, given that we have this Torah, which is focused on making people attached to God and ultimately leading toward prophecy, says the king, I would expect to see more ascetics and hermits among you. And the rabbi responds in paragraph 46 by saying, I regret that you have forgotten those fundamental principles in which you did concur. Did we not agree that man cannot approach God except by means of deeds commanded by him? Do you think that this can be gained by meekness, humility, etc. alone? What the rabbi is responding is by saying, is by challenging the assumption. The king assumes that the goal of mitzvot ought to be to reach a level of asceticism, of a hermit-like existence, of what in Hebrew we call sagfanut, of self-denial, and that is the way to achieve closeness to God. And the rabbi responds by saying something that we're not surprised to hear from Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, namely, or from the Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's protagonist in this particular story, namely that you're making a mistake. You're thinking that you can figure out how mitzvot ought to function, and you can't. You can only approach God by means of deeds commanded by him. So the king says, well, you're not entirely correct. Certainly and rightly so. I think I read in your books as follows. What does the Lord thy God require of thee but to fear the Lord thy God? Why does the Lord require of thee, etc.? He's quoting various psukim. And the rabbi says, these are the rational laws, being the basis and the preamble of the divine law, preceding it in character and time, and being indispensable in the administration of every human society. Even a gang of robbers must have a kind of justice among them if their confederacy is to last. Okay, so what the rabbi here does is begin by making a distinction that we've seen already in the Rambam. We've seen it already in the Rambam, although the Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is making it here prior to the Rambam, that there is a distinction between rational laws and non-rational laws, and that the rational laws are there indispensable in the administration of human society. In other words, in this passage, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, or the king, the rabbi in Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's story, is taking a step back from the extreme irrationalism. That is not to say the claim that you can only approach God through the mitzvot that has been commanded by him and not by speculating with your reason about what you ought to be doing or not doing. That claim is only true about one category of mitzvot. The first category of mitzvot are rational mitzvot, that is to say social, political mitzvot, that are designed to create a stable, just society. And as we saw in Rambam, a stable, just society is a prerequisite for spiritual success. So now, in order to avoid, if we talked about in Rambam, the strategies he has to use to avoid the pitfalls of extreme rationalism by taking a step back, limiting the kinds of reasons that can be found, historicizing things, etc. For Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi here, the step back is in a very different direction. The step back is to admit that there is something rational, but that reason is not the end of the discussion. Reason is not the whole discussion. There is something rational here. That rational thing is social, political. But that is really a prerequisite for what is ultimately more important, and that is spiritual. So, number one, we have a step back. Number two, if we skip further down to paragraph 50, Rabbi Alevi takes another half a step in giving an accounting of the non-rational mitzvot, the non-social and political mitzvot, that is not going to be purely rational, but is going to kind of give an accounting of mitzvot in slightly different terms. He says in paragraph 50, the divine law imposes no asceticism on us. It rather desires that we should keep the equipoise and grant every mental and physical faculty its due as much as it can bear without overburdening one faculty at the expense of another. If a person gives way to licentiousness, he blunts his mental faculty. He was inclined to violence, injures some other faculty. Prolonged fasting is no act of piety for a weak person who, having succeeded in checking his desires, is not greedy. For him, feasting is a burden and self-denial. Neither is diminution of wealth an act of piety. It is gained in a lawful way, if it is gained in a lawful way, if its acquisition does not interfere with study and good works, especially for him who has a household and children. In other words, what Rav Yehuda Levi seems to be doing here is suggesting that the goal of mitzvot cannot always be explained, but that the result of mitzvot, the function of mitzvot, is to create a certain kind of balanced personality. He is rejecting the asceticism that the king seems to take for granted, and suggesting instead that mitzvot are designed to create equipoise, the archaic word in this translation, and grant every mental and physical faculty its due as much as it can bear. In other words, for Rav Yehuda Alevi here, there is a certain system going on in mitzvot. They are not, you cannot explain each and every mitzvah, how it functions, but you can say that the overarching goal of various mitzvot is to create a certain kind of balanced, healthy personality, which Rav Yehuda Levi argues later on is part of what leads to an attachment to God and ultimately to prophecy. Now, I don't want to continue too much longer in Rav Yehuda Levi, because I want to use him as a foil for setting up Maharal's much more radical position. And in some ways, kind of developing Rav Yehuda Levi's position a few steps beyond what Rav Yehuda Levi himself had done. I wanted to introduce that by way of saying that even someone who has said you cannot approach God except through the mitzvot that He has commanded, you cannot figure out in advance what it is that we ought to be doing using your reason. You have to rely on what it is that God said. You cannot explain why each mitzvah is necessary. Still claims, in the end of the day, that there is a kind of system in mitzvot, and that mitzvot beyond the rational mitzvot that do exist, which are designed to maintain a stable society, there are also the result of observance is a kind of personality that is capable of prophecy. In answer to Binyamin's question on the chat, yes, the ultimate goal is prophecy. Prophecy is the sign that one has achieved closeness to God. But again, don't think that you can sit like one of the philosophers and figure out what the mechanics or the psychology of prophecy are. Become the kind of person who, according to philosophy, ought to become a prophet, and then just, you know, have it happen. That's the kind of rationalism that Maharal is rejecting. You can't figure it out. Prophecy is what happens when God gives it to you. God gives it to you if you become a holy person. Becoming a holy person involves some kind of balance, which is kind of the language that we saw. But it also, involves kind of obedience, and it involves this kind of whole network of rituals. And again, we'll see these ideas develop somewhat more radically in Maharal. But But yes, the ultimate goal is prophecy. Now I want to hop over to the seventh perek of Maharal's Tiferet Yisrael. We had taken a look at some passages in the sixth perek last week, and now I want to move on to Maharal's seventh perek, in which he tries to give a kind of larger... I want to avoid even the term explanation, because whatever he's doing here is not... It's very, very difficult. We'll have to try to figure out whether he's explaining anything at all, or what his language is designed to do. But I'm not sure I have a good answer to that question. But if you look at the website that has Tiferet Yisrael on it, you will see that it begins, it's kind of divided here into various paragraphs. If you look... about a third of the way down on the web page, there is a blue square bracket section heading that says Perusha Amarakia Torah Letzarefet HaBriot, and a paragraph that begins Omnam Masha Amar Lolatna Torah Rak Letzaref HaBriot. That is the paragraph that I want to begin focusing on. If anybody does not have it, please let me know. Does anybody not have that? Okay, I will take that as a yes, that everybody's got it. Okay? Umnam. Masha Amar lo natana Torah rak letzarei tabriot. He's quoting the Gemara that says that Torah is there to purify creatures. In hapirush, and the term tziruf here is purify in the sense that that metals are purified. You burn out the garbage in them with heat and fire, and then you get a more pure metal. That's the term mitzaref. Ina pirush ta mitzvot he mitzarfim ha'adam b'mashi adricha adam atzmo b'midot ha'tovot ba'gunot. The correct explanation is not that mitzvot purify man in that they guide man himself toward good character, good and proper character traits. If that were true, then we'd have the same problem we had in the previous section, which we had seen last week, namely that would explain certain mitzvot, but there are other mitzvot that can't be explained that way. There are mitzvot that don't have any moral purpose. There are mitzvot that don't seem linked in any way whatsoever to the character of an individual, right? And here he seems to be taking a swipe, certainly at Rambam, but also to a degree at Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who had said, no, we're trying to develop this kind of balanced character, not an ascetic, as the king seemed to have thought religion inevitably does, not an ascetic, but rather... For Rav Yehuda Halevi, this kind of personality, this balanced personality, says Maharal, don't think you can measure it in terms of the character traits of the individual. It's not even that. Aval mitzvot ba'atzman mitzarfim nefesh ha'adam lahashiv ota el Hashem. The mitzvot themselves purify the soul of a person to return it to God. V'lakach sider Hashem yitbarach mitzvot lo ta'aseh, ki al yidei seder hazeh ha'adam eno yotzei min ha'seder klal. And therefore, Hashem ordered the mitzvot lo ta'aseh, the negative commandments, the prohibitions, because through that order, a person does not deviate from the order at all. Okay, how do we make sense out of that sentence? Well, it seems to me that we begin to make sense out of that rather bizarre sentence by looking at the word that appears some four or five times in that sentence, and that word is seder, order. We have here a claim that there's some kind of order. He doesn't explain to us what the order is, although we do know that it is not rational and it is not merely character development. There is some kind of order, and through the mitzvot lo ta'aseh, and through the negative commandments, a person does not deviate from the order at all. And of course, it would be nice if we had some sense of what this order is and what Rav Yehuda, what Maharal means when he uses the term order. What is this order? But there is a kind of intuitive connection between the term order and mitzvot. Mitzvot, if you look at the kind of grand scheme of things, they do create an order. They do create a certain kind of pattern of behavior, a pattern of living and discipline. Course of the year, over the course of the day, over the course of the week, there are certain kinds of patterns, orders, that a life of mitzvot develops. So Maharal seems very interested in this notion of order. Now if we skip a little bit, skip down to the paragraph that begins, Omnam Yisrael Am Hashem. Here it's in red letters. Okay. He says, continuing the previous thought once again, if you don't have the passage in question, please let me know. Order, i.e. habituating oneself. That is certainly possible, asks Benjamin in the chat. He has not yet given us a definition of what the order is that he's talking about. If it's habituating oneself, that of course begs the question, habituating oneself toward what? And we've already seen him reject even the kind of modest explanation of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that it develops a certain kind of personality, that you can measure it in terms of personality traits. You can't measure it in terms of personality traits. So my sense is that Maharal is working on something beyond merely character training or habituating oneself, that there's something above and beyond it. And we'll have to take a look at the language that he uses in this next section. Okay? Notice, by the way, in the previous sentence that we had learned, that he had identified mitzvot lo ta'aseh, the prohibitions which keep you from deviating from the order, and he's setting up a kind of contrast or a kind of two sides of the coin of the mitzvot lo ta'aseh, which prevent you from deviating from the order, and then there's also going to be on the other side of the coin mitzvot aseh, which somehow, well, as we'll see in a second, are going to push you toward that order. He says in this paragraph, Omnam Yisrael Am Hashem. Yisrael are the nation of God, Asher Bachar Bahem, which he chose, which God had chosen, V'nit Yachdu El Hashem Yitbarach Yoter V'yoter, and they are specified for Hashem, for God, more and more, She'esh Lahem Nefesh Miyuchedet Elohit B'yoter. They have a unique soul that is increasingly, that is greatly divine. Okay, so Maharal is also mentioning in this context an idea that he develops elsewhere at length. I don't want to get sidetracked on the question of racism or what have you, but Maharal believed unquestionably that the nature of the Jewish soul was different than the nature of the Gentile soul, categorically different, and the nature of the Jewish soul was such that it and only it had a special connection to God, to spirituality. In other words, somehow this order, and again, I don't want to get sidetracked, it's an interesting question, but I don't want to get sidetracked in the question of racism or racial differences between Jews and Gentiles. Maharal clearly falls into those groups in Jewish thought who see Jews and Gentiles as inherently different, and the difference stemming from a different kind of soul, as Binyamin points out, also very different from Rambam's position. Yes, very different from Rambam's position. For Rambam, humans are humans, and what distinguishes Jews from Gentiles is Torah, that we have Torah and they don't, although they're welcome to join us. And Torah is kind of this rational system for achieving human perfection, and is therefore terribly effective. But in terms of the nature of the person, there isn't a fundamental difference between Jews and non-Jews. We're just people. And here, for Maharal and for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and for Kabbalah, the Jews and Gentiles are inherently different. They're essentially different. There's an essential difference between them. So therefore, since Jews have this unique soul, says Maharal, mityachdu od b'mitzvot lo ta'aseh shehem shisa, kefi asher hem miyuchadim mityachdu yoter shele yitzu mi'aseder haro'i. Since these Jews are different, they are unique in that they have mitzvot lo ta'aseh, prohibitions, shisa, 365, which are unique, and that prevent them from deviating from the order, the proper order. Again, the term order appears, not deviating. Va'od mityachdu b'mitzvot aseh, shehem ramach mitzvot. And they also have 248 positive commandments. Ki hanefesh shehi omedet baguf, because the soul which sits in the body, nope atzma el hateva, tends toward nature. V'hi be'emet nefesh elokit milamala, but it is in fact a divine soul from above, rak shehi omedet baguf, only it is stuck in the body. Tzarich lehotzi ota min hateva, you have to move it out of nature, v'lihiyot la dvekut bo yitbarach, so that there can be connection to him, may he be blessed to God. Okay, so if word number one, if buzzword number one in Maharal is Seder, the other buzzwords we have here are teva, nature. Nature is contrasted to divinity. Nature is the opposite of divinity. And attachment of the soul to divinity is dependent on removing it from nature. In other words, there's a whole kind of philosophical anthropology that's hidden under here, at least an anthropology of Jews, right? A kind of philosophical explanation of what it means to be human. What it means to be human, according to these passages, is to be a being that is torn between a natural physical body and a spiritual soul, which are, to a certain degree, at war with one another, in conflict with one another. If you want to achieve spirituality, you have to defeat nature. Again, a kind of critique of kind of moving in the direction of asceticism that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi had rejected. Maharal is taking it a step further. No, there is a sense of asceticism. There is a goal of removing yourself from nature, removing yourself from physicality, squashing your physicality. V'zehu al yedei mitzvot. That is through mitzvot. The way in which one removes oneself from nature is through mitzvot. In other words, if we have this contrast between nature and spirituality, the seder, the order that he'd spoken about before, is on the spirituality side. V'zehu al yedei mitzvot asher ma'aseh mitzvot ulefi ha'seichel asher mesudar la'adam. And that is through mitzvot, because the mitzvah actions follow the seichel, which is ordered for man. Now, it is very tempting to misunderstand the term seichel in this passage. Seichel, for Maharal, does not mean reason or rationality. It means spirituality. Seichel is the term that Maharal uses when he wants to distinguish between spirituality and physicality. Spirituality is sikhli, by which he means disembodied, beyond nature. Va'al yidei she'oseh ha-mitzvah shehu seder sikhli, and through the fact, or through by the fact that he does a mitzvah, which is a seder sikhli, a spiritual order, yesh la'adam dvekut basikhli, a person has attachment to the spiritual, v'yotzei min ha-teva she'adam chomed bo, and he deviates from nature, which a person desires, va'az yesh lo dvekut bo, and then he is attached to God. Okay, if I had a kind of blackboard here, it would be a little bit easier, but there's a kind of an elaborate equation going on here, and it's an elaborate equation that I can explain how the words relate to each other, but there's a certain problem, right? We have teva, which is in contrast to seichel. Teva is not equal to seichel. Teva is the opposite of seichel. The person can either go down the teva route or down the seichel route. The teva route leads one toward materiality. The seichel route leads one toward spirituality. The seichel route is defined by seder, by order. That order are mitzvot, or mitzvot are the things that prevent the person, mitzvot lo taseh, prevent the person from deviating from the order. And the positive commandments are the ones that put him into that order. So we've got this kind of equation, right? Again, teva is not equal to seichel, seichel is equal to seder. Teva is equal to seichel is equal, spirituality is equal to order, and the mitzvot achieve that order. By going in the order of the mitzvot, then you end up with dveikut, with attachment to God. Is teva chaos? Asks Binyamin. I don't think so. And we're going to see another passage in a second, which I think points exactly in the opposite direction. In other words, what interests me is that teva is also an order. Nature is ordered, and Maharal knows that nature is ordered. Maharal knows that nature is not random. And if we go back to his original explanation, right? Remember his original attack on the philosophers that we talked about last week. They can't give a complete accounting of nature. So maybe nature is not entirely rational. Maybe nature itself cannot entirely be explained through reason. On the other hand, nature is characterized by order, in the sense that things continue habitually to do the same thing. Summer, fall, winter, spring happens over and over again. Birth, death, growth, the ecological cycle of eating and excretion of procreation, there's an order there. And the notion that teva is I think not so much chaos as much as it's a different kind of order. And we'll see the mashal, he's going to use a mashal of a plant or a seed in a second, but we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. I just want to point to the problem in figuring out the passage we just read. Even if we can unpack this equation of teva is the opposite of seichel, which is seder, which leads to dveikut, etc. The problem, I think, primarily is that we can't define any of the terms. We have teva, we have seder, we have seichel, we have dveikut. I don't know what any of those terms mean in this context. And that makes it hard. In other words, this is kind of a general comment about understanding Maharal as a whole. Maharal is fond of just this kind of literary exercise, of making these elaborate, long equations between different concepts. And then you kind of look back and say, well, what does he mean by all of that? Because you can't define a single one of the terms that he's used. And the obvious solution to that problem is to read more carefully and discover where in this paragraph or where in this chapter he defines the terms that he's using. But unfortunately, to the best of my knowledge, he doesn't. And one of the things Maharal does not do consistently is define his terms. He uses all kinds of terms, equates all kinds of things with each other. But even if I know, according to him, that seichel is seder, which leads to dveikut, and that mitzvot are fitting to the seder, I still don't know what any of those terms mean. So what exactly is he talking about? So here he follows up with a passage, the next paragraph, Vida, if you have it in your on the page, Vida Od. So in purple here, Vida Od, and no in addition. And I want to go, I want to read through that paragraph because I think it gives us a clue as to what he's about and the kind of language he thinks that it is appropriate to use in explaining mitzvot, or really the limits of our ability to explain mitzvot. He says, V'da'o, the no, in addition, ki ha-gar'in asher nizra ba'adama, the seed that is planted in the ground, hu motzi ilanu peirot va'alim va'anafim, it brings forth a tree, fruit, leaves, and branches. The ha'alim v'ha'pirot him b'tzura miyuchedet shera'u yel ha'garim mitzad tiv'o ha'miyuchad lo. And the leaves and the fruit are in a particular form which is appropriate to the nature of the seed, the unique nature of the seed. In other words, what's he starting with? He's starting with, in this mashal of a seed, mashal of seeds were very popular. Rabbi Yehuda Levi has several of them, mashals of seeds. The seed is planted in the ground, and lo and behold, when you plant a lemon seed, what emerges is a lemon tree. That's fact number one in his mashal. If you plant an apple seed, what emerges, if you take care of it properly, is an apple tree. V'al tomar shimaya motzi ha'anafim v'ha'alim b'tzura acheret shaya zerach. Don't say that if it would have emerged leaves in a different form, that would be evil. Rakikach gazar hateva shel hagar'in. But rather, that is what was determined by the nature of the seed, uvitzura zot, in that form, uvitoar hazeh, and in this description, yotzei hagarin hazeh el hapoel hagamur. That is how this particular seed achieves, actualizes its potential. V'hu b'shleimut kasher motzi ha'alim v'haperot kifi masher ra'ui el teva hagarin. And it is perfected when the leaves and the fruit emerge based on what's appropriate for the nature of the seed. So now he's taking it a step further. That is what the lemon seed ought to do. We don't say that the emergence of different kinds of trees from different kinds of seeds are evil. What we do say is, rather, that each seed is distinctive. When it is put in the ground, it grows in a distinctive kind of way, and in a consistent kind of way that results in the growth of another version of whatever it is that you planted. That's the mashal. The mashal is that when you plant a seed, you get consistent results that follow the nature of the seed, and using a kind of medieval language, that is the perfection of the seed. That is the actualization of the seed. Now, this is an interesting mashal, especially in light of his kind of sarcastic remarks from last week about natural science. Maharal is not unaware, is not ignorant of the natural science that's available. He agrees, he knows full well that science, or that nature, runs consistently. That there are some rules that govern nature. You don't plant a lemon seed and get an apple tree, and vice versa. If you plant lemon seeds, you consistently get lemon trees. Tomato seeds get tomato plants. There is a consistency in nature, and it is almost tempting to say in this context, though Maharal doesn't use the term, there is order in nature. There is consistency. A certain potential is actualized in a consistent kind of way. That is predetermined uniqueness. Yes, that is a good way of expressing it. Right? There's a certain predetermined uniqueness, and it's consistent. Ukamochein atzmo nefesh. Now we get into the nimshal, into what this mashal is designed to explain. Ukamochein atzmo hanefesh shehi lamala. The soul, which is above. Well, where is the soul? What he had just told us a minute ago, that what happens to the divine soul from above? That it is embedded in the materiality of the body. Sounds familiar, right? Just like the seed is embedded in the ground. the soul is embedded in the body. V'hi zaka u'tohora v'netna b'guf ha'adam l'mata. It is pure, and it is put in the body below. V'tzarich shiyotzi ota el ha'po'al, and you have to actualize it. The soul is a seed in the body, and that body, that seed, has to be actualized. Kamo shehagar'in yotze el ha'po'al min ha'adama shenizrabo, in the same way that the seed is actualized out of the ground in which it is planted. V'hi yotzeit el ha'po'al kafi ma shera'ui la'nefesh. And it emerges, it becomes actualized based on what is appropriate for the soul. V'ka'asher yatza ha'nefesh el ha'po'al hi b'shleimut. And when the soul is actualized, it is perfected. Okay. Let me see if I can try to explain what I think that he's doing here. The soul in the body, so it's like the old SAT questions, although I understand from my students that they've eliminated this part of the SAT from the new SATs, but the analogies, right? The soul in the body is like the seed in the ground. The seed in the ground emerges in a particular kind of way. The lemon seed always produces lemon trees. You cannot demand that a lemon seed will produce an apple tree. However, you also can't explain exactly why it is that lemon trees produce I'm not doing a good job. Let me do it one more time. There is an order to nature. The lemon seed could produce nothing other than the lemon tree. But you can't explain why lemons and not something else. You can't explain why nature has produced lemons, apples, oranges, a whole bunch of things, and not other things that nature does not produce. In other words, nature, this mashal of the seed, is an attempt to explain what he means by order, and to find a middle ground between necessity and arbitrariness. Mitzvot are necessary in the sense that a lemon seed produces a lemon tree. It couldn't be otherwise. Once you have the lemon seed, and once you have a soul, the kind of behavior, the kind of actions that are going to emerge from that soul are already there in the nature of the soul. They couldn't be otherwise. There is no way to actualize the divine soul other than by keeping mitzvot, by producing a lemon tree. Now you want to ask, why is it that lemon seeds produce lemon trees, and why is it that souls produce mitzvot and not other kinds of activities, or souls are designed to produce mitzvot and not other activities? Well, you'd have to know more about the nature, why nature is the way it is and not some other hypothetical way, to give an answer to that question, but you can't know that. There is an order there. It couldn't be otherwise, but that doesn't mean you have a complete explanation of it. Somehow these behaviors, keeping Shabbat, not wearing shatnez, blowing the shofar in Rosh Hashanah, are the kinds of activities that emerge from the kind of soul which we have been given. And there couldn't be any other mitzvot that would actualize that soul, that would actualize, that would bring the soul to actualization. But that doesn't mean you have a full explanation of it. So Binyamin says, doing mitzvot affects proper development of the soul. Correct. Doing mitzvot is the way of kind of creating the conditions under which the soul grows. It's the water and the sun and the soil and the nutrients, all those things that allow the soul to flower into what it inevitably flowers into if it's given the right conditions, in the same way that the lemon seed inevitably flowers into a lemon tree if it's given the right conditions. So this mashal allows Maharal to find a different space between explanation and randomness, between explanation and arbitrariness. On the other hand,
I'm sorry to interrupt. Could it be that, this is Yaman again, that just like we don't understand how a lemon tree grows, but it just does, and all these miraculous things, or quote-unquote miraculous things occur, we don't understand it. So it speaks to the irrational aspect of this. So in the same way, the soul, we don't understand the mitzvot, and we can try to understand them, but just like we don't fully figure out the DNA of a lemon tree, etc., so it could very well be beyond us to understand how a soul develops, but the same sort of processes are in place, and if you were to do something which is not, let's say, healthy for the soul, i.e., if you're over one of the losa says, so you will be essentially distorting or perverting the cosmic plan. Could that be it?
I think that is a very good summary of what he's doing, right? To deviate from one of the lotases, to violate the Shabbat, would be like denying water to the sea. It might continue to grow, but it is going to grow in a kind of twisted or inadequate way. It's not going to grow properly. It's not going to develop to its full potential. How would Rambam respond to this analogy, Judy asks? That's a very good question. How would Rambam respond to this analogy? Here's just a guess. I don't know if this is a full answer, but I think he would say, if you'll pardon the expression, that you're comparing apples to oranges, and Maharal is comparing apples to oranges. Human development in society is one thing. The development of, you know, plants is another thing. Let's treat each one the way they ought to be treated. Let's treat science, kind of figuring out how plants work. Let's figure out how plants work to the extent that we can figure out how plants work. You want to ask me how individuals develop in society to develop their spiritual and religious perfection? That's a separate question, and the tools of reason can help me answer that question. I can learn something about human nature. I can learn something about the human condition. I can learn something about human beings as social beings. And then I can figure out what kind of legal system would help bring them to perfection under those circumstances. Does that have anything to do with an analogy to nature? No, not necessarily. They're two different questions. You might use different tools to figure out nature than you would use to figure out an individual in society. And, you know, ask different questions and come up with different answers. That is my sense of how Rambam would respond to the analogy. I also think that Rambam would insist in reading this passage, and again, we're being a little anachronistic, Rambam would insist in reading this passage in defining terms. Don't talk to me about order. Don't talk to me about nature. Don't talk to me about dvekut. Define what you mean. If you can't give those terms definitions, then you haven't succeeded in explaining anything at all. In other words, part of what we were saying last week, that Rambam's rationalist sensibility is so different, especially from the radicalism here of Maharal, that he's just, they would have trouble getting a conversation started. They would be talking at cross purposes. They would be talking at each other. At least, again, by way of analogy, if I imagined, you know, two people who seem Rambam-like and Maharal-like, talking to each other, you can imagine the conversation just getting stuck, which the Rambam insisting on definitions for terms, and Maharal insisting that definitions are just too closed to explain the world that he lives in. I mean, part of my own experience studying Maharal, and I don't claim to be an expert at all, is that I began to feel that I understood what I didn't understand about Maharal when I came to the realization that he looked out at the world and saw things very differently than the way I see things intuitively. That's not by means of making a judgment. He may well be right, and my intuitive way of looking at the world was entirely wrong. That's fine. But he just lives in a world that is so mystically connected, in which every object is symbolic of something much larger, in which nothing is merely what it appears to be. That it kind of took me a while reading Maharal to get to kind of understand that he looked out at the world and saw something very different than what I saw. And at least that helped me come to grips with what I think I don't understand about Maharal. And there's a great deal that I don't understand about Maharal. One of the things that I like about these particular prakim is that I managed to make at least some sense of them. In any event, I want to take a look at one more sentence here in Maharal, because we're running out of time, and that is, he says, Rakizehu ha-hefresh. There is one difference between the mashal and the nimshal here. Ki ha-ilan hotza'at Torah anafim ba'alim b'tzorat nifer ha-perot ha-koli tiv'i, aval ha-adam ha-kol mitzat ha-nefesh, ki'in ma'alatoa ha-chorna tiv'it klal, rakyesh la-adam nefesh ha-lotit miyuchedet. The prime difference is that the seed operates in nature. The inherent logic of the seed is a natural logic, and the inherent logic of the soul is a spiritual, supernatural logic. But the idea that there is some inherent logic that can never quite be pinned down, in the same way that nature, you can explain how it functions within itself, but you can't explain why nature is the way it is and not some other way. Right? I can explain how gravity functions, but I can't explain why there is gravity at all. I can explain, I'm not enough of a scientist to come up with good examples, but, you know, I can explain, you know, what the implications are of the particular chemical properties of this or, you know, that chemical. I can't explain why there are chemicals at all. So I can explain, or either once I have a soul, it is the mitzvot are an inevitable consequence of the structure of that soul, but I can't explain why souls and not something else. I think that is what Maharal is working on. Okay, so what we've done in the last 3 weeks, in the grand scheme of things, is to kind of map out two patterns, Rambam's radical rationalist pattern, and Maharal and Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's irrationalist and non-rationalist pattern. But we've even seen that Maharal and Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi are not prepared to do away with explanation. They don't think you can explain everything, but they still think there is some kind of language that you can use to give an accounting of what mitzvot are. They are not arbitrary. And that is going to lead us way ahead into the future, to two 20th century thinkers for the last 2 weeks of our discussion. Next week I want to talk about the great Israeli philosopher Yishayahu Leibovitz, whose theory of Ta'amei HaMitzvot is exactly an attempt to do mitzvot as arbitrary. To take, if you will, although he would not appreciate the analogy, to take Maharal to the nth degree, or to take the irrationalism to the nth degree, although he perceives himself as a rationalist, to look at the kind of arguments he brings for mitzvot as arbitrary, and then to compare that to a position that shares some of the assumptions, but not the conclusion, the position that Rav Soloveitchik suggests in one of his less well-known but very important books, The Halachic Mind, which is an elaborate theory of Ta'amei HaMitzvot, the way he is also responding to a kind of, both Leibovitz and Rav Soloveitchik are involved in this kind of larger skeptical attempt, what we can understand and not understand, we can't really know all that much about Torah and Mitzvot and about God, and how that translates into not an anti-rational, but kind of skeptical, almost human interpretation of mitzvot, but that will have to wait for the next couple of weeks. Anybody have any other questions? If not, then God willing, we'll meet again, or virtually meet again, on a week from today. Any last questions? Okay, what I'm going to do one more time, I'm just going to put my email address in the chat. If you send me I'm going to try to send the sources very early this week through the Torah in Motion people so they can send them off to everybody, because I don't have them on the web for next week. But if you send me a direct email to my email address, then I will try to send them to you directly as well. And God willing, next week, same time, same website. Thank you.